Say good morning to each one. Glad to be here, worship with you this morning. I guess my topic is a little bit of the thought processes maybe I've been thinking about the last while, and maybe work better to have open discussion on it and back and forth debate like Sunday school, but I guess, yeah, I don't know how that'll all go, but maybe it's a controversial subject in a way where we would have different thoughts or opinions, and that's fine and okay also, I think. But culture, what is culture? I don't know that I've really heard many messages to that subject. And I don't know what definition you put to culture or what culture is. It's something, we don't use that word on a day-to-day basis really too much, I don't think, at least I don't. But yeah, the definition of culture could go many different directions, I guess. But you think of society, it kind of has a culture. In different parts of the world, there's different cultures, we say. It's just kind of the method or the way things get done. And then you have a church culture and a community culture. And so there's not one set culture necessarily, but culture applies to many different segments of life and areas. And so maybe church culture is more what I'm speaking about. So a definition could be our beliefs, our behaviors, and values shared by a group of people. And I think culture obviously has a lot, mostly when we talk about culture, has to do with a group of people and how their behaviors, their beliefs, the values, how they blend them together and have a common, kind of a common goal with that culture. And as we think of culture, maybe you had some type of resistance came up within you. I don't know, when you heard that word, it's like, I don't know if I want to hear about culture. And I wonder if that's because we often put the word tradition, or traditions is another word that can be very similar to culture, and that word's even bites maybe harder, because it's like this tradition thing can be, maybe it was you know, kind of used as a word or a method of trying to get us to do something somewhere in our lives that we didn't understand or we didn't think made sense, but it's a traditional thing, so we were kind of pressured or asked to just do it because it's a tradition. It's a good thing because it's a tradition, and continue it, and it's kind of left hanging there as to what value does tradition have without explanation or a base around it. I mean, I guess I don't know. But I mean, for me, I separate culture and tradition as two different. They do intermix and intertwine very much, and yet culture and traditions. I place culture on a little bit of a different level than I do traditions. I think culture has more to do with core beliefs, I think, and how those are worked out in our lives as individuals, and then as a group coming together, creating a culture. So yes, it does start as an individual, but then it's intertwined as a group is what creates culture. And I think that's the powerfulness of a brotherhood or of a community of believers is that the force that can be created, and culture can be, and I'll say from the onstart, can be a very good thing, or it can equally have a bad influence. It's very influential. Culture is very influential, I guess maybe you would say. And so we do have to be very careful as we develop culture, as it were, that it's a good culture and a healthy culture. And maybe if you don't get anything from the message this morning other than culture is being developed, whether we want it to be or not. And so when you think of it that way, that if you just do nothing and you don't want to deal with culture, you don't want to deal with tradition, just let that all sit, well, there's going to be a culture kind of come out of that mentality. And so if there's going to be a culture, my plea this morning is, why not be intentional about developing a healthy culture, a culture that's going to move the church forward, is going to move the kingdom work forward. And I see it as a tremendous vehicle of church life. We talk about passing on the faith, and what does it mean? What does it mean to pass on the faith? That phrase we've heard, but how do you do that? And I think culture is maybe one of the more important factors or influences of the vehicle to move our core values, our faith in this generation to the next generation. And if without being intentional about it, there likely will be unhealthy factors left go unchecked in a culture. So I think intentionality is an important part. And I'm speaking to myself again, like we ministers often say, I have not really, I've wondered when your culture, just let it happen. It's just going to happen, and don't worry too much about it. Just read the Bible and be saved and do it. But I ain't sure that approach passes on a core value that we would desire to have passed on to our children, to the next generation or the future generations. So why not? My encouragement is, why not look at culture and use it for a very important tool, if you want to call it, of moving forward. And I think why we do, tradition gets talked about in a negative connotation a fair number of times by Jesus himself. And when we read those scriptures, it's like we have right to pretty much, just avoid traditions then also. And it wasn't really Jesus' point that traditions are bad. And tradition and culture is not inherently evil or whatever we say. But there are cautions around those subjects that we do have to pay attention to. And the passage, just to try to maybe for us to grasp what I'm saying is in Matthew 15, verses 1 to 9, and I'm just going to read those verses. Matthew 15, 1 to 9 says, "Then came to Jesus scribes and Pharisees, which were of Jerusalem, saying, Why do thy disciples transgress the tradition of the elders? For they wash not their hands when they eat bread. But he answered and said unto them, Why do ye also transgress the commandment of God by your tradition? For God commanded, saying, Honor thy father and mother, and he that curseth father and mother, let him die the death. But ye say, Whosoever shall say to his father or his mother, It is a gift, by whatsoever thou mightest be profited by me, and honor not his father or his mother, he shall be free. Thus have ye made the commandment of God of none effect by your tradition. Ye hypocrites, well did Isaiah prophesy of you, saying, This people draweth nigh unto me with their mouth, and honoreth me with their lips, but their heart is far from me." Okay, these verses, as I read them, it doesn't make real clear sense, just a quick read. But I think what Jesus, well, to me, what Jesus was, the scribes and the Pharisees came to Jesus and asked him this question. I mean, why don't your disciples wash their hands before they eat? And basically a condemning or a critical spirit that they had. And this washing of hands was more than just being sanitary, likely, from what I've studied and read. It was a ritual, kind of a religious ceremony that the scribes and Pharisees would tend to let water, cold water, drip down over their hands or whatever in a ritualistic way that they wouldn't be tainted by the meat in some way or whatever. So it was something that that they came up with. It wasn't a scriptural backed directive that God had ever given them necessarily, and in and of itself was kind of neither here nor there, likely. But here the scribes and Pharisees were placing this on a pretty high level, and they were accusing Jesus of not following their traditions. And so I think we get that. And Jesus comes back and rebuttal to them, saying, you know, what about you guys? You're going against something that was a direct commandment of God. So tradition in this case was Jesus did not have a good thought surrounding that, because the tradition was getting more importance than God's commandment. And what Jesus pointed out to them was that here what was happening is that in the Ten Commandments, it's clearly given that you're supposed to honor your father and mother. But these scribes and Pharisees were bypassing that commandment and saying, well, we're giving all of our money to the treasury of that time. So to try to get it closer to us than that, it's like if I have my mom and dad have a financial need and I come here on a Sunday morning, we have Brotherhood Assistance offering, I put all my financial extra that I have in the Brotherhood Assistance Fund here at this church and go to my mom and dad and say, well, I don't have any money to help you with because I just gave mine all into the offering. It's like Jesus was saying that's what these guys were doing. They were building up the treasury in their synagogues, padding their own pockets basically, but letting their father and mother go with the need and not honoring them. And so that's what Jesus was saying. Man-made tradition has become more important to you than God's law. So I think you get that. So for us, as I said, culture and tradition mix back and forth so much that they are somewhat similar. But I mean, we have communion. We observe the Lord's Supper and communion. And that's a direct command from Scripture. So that's not, we don't consider that a tradition, although we do it two times a year. So nowhere in Scripture does it say how many times they do to have communion. So it's traditional that we do it two times a year, but it's not a traditional service from the fact that it was commanded of God. So I believe culture is working out our beliefs and values. If you want to turn to 1 Corinthians 3. First Corinthians 3, verses 4 to 15. And I'm just breaking in here, but this first part's fairly familiar. It says, "For while one saith, I'm Paul, and another, I'm Apollos, are ye not carnal?" And then Paul moves into this thing. "Who then is Paul, and who is Apollos, but ministers by whom ye believed, even as the Lord gave to every man? I have planted, Apollos watered, but God gave the increase. So then neither is he that planteth anything, neither he that watereth, but God that giveth the increase. Now he that planteth and he that watereth are one, and every man shall receive his own reward according to his own labor. For we are laborers together with God, ye are God's husbandry, ye are God's building. According to the grace of God which is given unto me as a wise master builder, I have laid the foundation, and another buildeth thereon. But let every man take heed how he buildeth thereupon. For other foundation can no man lay than that is laid, which is Jesus Christ. Now if any man build upon this foundation, gold, silver, precious stones, wood, hay, stubble, every man's work shall be made manifest, for the day shall declare it, because it shall be revealed by fire, and the fire shall try every man's work of what sort it is. If any man's work abide which he hath built thereupon, he shall receive a reward. If any man's work shall be burned, he shall suffer loss, but he himself shall be saved, yet so as by fire." So I'm not sure, I don't want to take this passage out of context, but I think there's different directions it can go. Basically, you see Paul here leveling the playing field and saying man is not looked to, no one man has it all figured out, but it's the culmination of men doing their part is where safety is, I guess you could say. But on more than that, as Paul, I see, said clear that he has laid the foundation. And what was that foundation? It was Jesus Christ and salvation. And he makes it very clear, if you go to different passages, and I think we all agree, that Paul's message was Jesus and Jesus crucified, and what that change brings in a person's life, because he was struck down on the way to Damascus or whatever. That was his born-again experience, and he was preaching that as a foundation, and that cannot be argued, and it is not arguable. And he says it here in verse 11, "For other foundation can no man lay than that is laid, which is Jesus Christ." He said, my work here was laying the foundation, and he did well at that. And Mars Hill, when he was philosophizing with those people, and he said, "I perceive you're too superstitious. You're making a god out of wood, and you're just grasping for straws to find God in anything." And he goes on, how it's Jesus Christ that you're missing. It's him, and his resurrection is where salvation is, and without salvation, you have nothing to build on. And so we have that, and we have Paul saying that here in this passage. But then he says that that's not the end. Because in verse 10 it says, "But let every man take heed how he buildeth thereupon." There needs to be building, there needs to be development of our Christian life above and beyond salvation. And I think that's what he moves on into what he was saying, and I'm trying to decipher maybe what he's saying. But we know there's no other foundation can be laid other than Jesus Christ. But it's in verse 12, "Now if any man build upon this foundation," and he goes through what the valuable elements that can be built there, or the lesser valuable things like wood and chaff. So I think, to me, that this passage can back up the thought of culture. Is culture not involved with the building upon the foundation? And sometimes I wonder if we in our churches, and I'm not trying to be critical here, I'm just trying to be open and make sense of church and Christianity or whatever. Do we actually, I think we do very well at emphasizing Jesus Christ and salvation, and that you must be born again. That needs preached and preached loud and clear. But is there preaching, is there teaching, is there culture being promoted and talked about after salvation that maybe we lack on some? Because if we just preach salvation, and I hesitate to even say it because it sounds like I'm trying to minimize the work of Jesus Christ, but I'm like Paul, that's the foundation, but build upon it. It's not minimizing Jesus' blood and his work to think past that and what's next. If we only preach salvation, and that's kind of an end in itself, what vision are we pushing forward for our younger generation? What excitement do they see in us older ones, that if we're saved now, we're born again, and so we sit and put in our time, it doesn't inspire the desire for them to be involved. Maybe I should say it that way. So there has to be some elements that bring energy into church life in a way that we all want to be involved, young, from the youngest to the oldest, and create an atmosphere where there is safety, where there's comfort, and where there's a vision, where there's a goal, and where there's a desire to build a strong, sturdy building on this foundation that brings stability and is able to stand the wind. In the parable of this building upon the rock and the sand, without the foundation, the building will fall. After you have the foundation, you still need to pay attention to what kind of materials you're using to build on the rock, because if you you might be building upon a perfect foundation, but you can't be sloppy thereafter and say, well, I can just stick up the use straw and mud like the three little pigs or whoever, and think that because I have a solid foundation, then I can do whatever on the house and I'm going to be okay. I see that in this passage, that we're encouraged to pay extreme attention to what the process after salvation, that the time and energy we spend are being spent in a way that's going to have a benefit and effect not only in our personal lives, but it's going to infiltrate those around us, in our churches, in our families, and the time and energy we spend is quality. And what all that looks like, well, I'm at a loss myself somewhat to cast the vision of what all that entails, but my desire this morning is to simply get us thinking along that thought of what do we want at Cornerstone? What's our vision? What's our goal? What do we want to hand to the next generation? And without clarity of or the importance of that, I think we will be less effective than we could be. And I think back to maybe it's just me, but I haven't always looked back in history to the Anabaptists and to the Christians that have walked the same walk we're walking today. Maybe it was a different time era and they had different issues, but the core needs and the core temptations and all that were basically the same. It comes in a different package, maybe. But we can easily just throw the history out and say, well, that was them. I got to live my life today. I mean, they're not here anymore. They had to do what they had to do. Now I got to figure it out myself. I think it's doing ourselves a disservice not to look at some patterns and some... We're not the first Christians here has to walk this life today and from here forward. There's been many of faithful Christians that have done it before us. And is it not to our advantage or save us a lot of downfalls if we can look back and see what has stood the test of time, what has worked? And automatically your minds probably are there now, already ahead of mine, before I can say it. Well, if you're going to start looking back and you're going to start saying, well, they did this, so we want to do this, and we want to do this, and we want to do it this way, and start writing it down, then you're going to start squirming, thinking, well, then if this becomes a works thing and a performance thing, and there's no life in it, so if there's no life in it, I don't want to do it. But it's the same as many other subjects we talk about. There's a ditch on either side of this, and we are called to find the balance or the road in between. It's a narrow road, and it's a road that's a little hard to see at times. You can't see real far in the future, but I think it would be beneficial if we can try to learn what we can learn from the past, and then also have a goal for the future. And if you can compile that, the components of those two, it will set us on a path that would be helpful. Because I think we need to be looking more at longevity in our Christian lives. And it's not just about me and doing the right thing today, but yeah, how will my decisions today affect the next generation? And if we're not concerned about the next generation, or if we're not concerned about how my belief is going to affect that, then I don't know if we're not taking our Christian life very serious. If it doesn't matter what happens after us. I know everyone has to make their own decision. We can't make other people's decisions for them. But as a group, if we come together with a vision and a goal and build with good materials on the foundation, it will be more energizing and encouraging and attractive for those to stay with us or come to us. And yeah, I think you know what I mean by that. And my thoughts might be just, I'm kind of not really just, maybe my thoughts will be a little bit sporadic, but in those thoughts, maybe you get something that will spark your thoughts. So there's a church culture and there's a world culture, and we live in this world, but we're not of the world. So we do have to deal with the world's culture along with church culture, and that's a kind of a different aspect or element, but we do need to deal with that. And developing or creating a healthy culture within a church, we do have to take at least realize what's going on in the world culture, I think. Not that we just want to do the opposite of what the world's culture is to feel safety in that. That's not it at all. And another thing is, sometimes we hear that the church is just 10 years behind the world or one generation. And that's a pretty bleak outlook. If we're setting our culture or gauging the health of our culture, well, the world does it this way, we're going to do it this way, so that makes us okay. I don't think... That's a very bleak outlook if we're doing it that way. But world culture affects us in our daily lives and in our church culture, whether we want it to or not. So we do have to take that into consideration. And I think it's going to call for wisdom to know what cultural issues do you feel like we have to buck against, or which cultural issues are simply cultural without a deep spiritual element to them that don't need to really be addressed that hard. And you know, Nolan or someone would know this much better than I, but I understand it. If you're in Europe, they drive on the different side of the road than we do. Go to the opposite, on the opposite side, or whatever, however you want to word that. So you could go over there and say, I drive on this side of the road, this is my culture, your culture may be this, but I'm going to do it my way. You probably won't last very long. If you're bucking, go, if you get on 81 and say, I'm from Europe, I'm going to drive on the opposite side because I want to go. You get my point. It's a cultural, two different cultures made a decision to do things two different ways, and it has no spiritual connection at all. And so that is called, I think that's where wisdom comes in. Sometimes even in our churches, it seems like maybe someone's coming straight towards you when you think the only way to go is the way you're going. And so it calls us to consider the elements and components around that. So, just for another thought, I mean, I'm not going to spend much time at all on this, but the thought of world culture and church culture, you have the thing of debt. If you read the Bible, debt is definitely not something that's promoted and held to something we should attain to be heavily in debt in Scripture as you read that. But the world's culture, and from whenever it started in the 80s or 70s, it became that, you know, buy now, pay later, and consumer demand. And so debt was promoted in the world of culture to the point where a business person today, even though he wants to live a biblical culture, it's I'll say well nigh impossible to be a businessman without incurring some type of debt somewhere along in the process. And so there again, it calls for looking at both and trying to find a balance between the two. And I think church culture should override the worldly culture, and yet we're living here in this world, so there are some things. Yeah, I don't know how to finish that thought, but we hesitate, and we understand the concept that debt well above and beyond what we could ever pay is wrong. But debt for business that is a God-fearing business that's reaching lives or supporting different families and so forth, if it's manageable, then we allow that because it seems like you have to. And I know I'm not getting a very good hard line on that. And that's somewhat comes down to an individual then too. But I think you know maybe what I'm trying to get at. The other thing I want to realize about culture is culture comes in a package. So your behaviors, your core beliefs as they're worked out, there's many different elements that create culture and our culture. So from which side of the road you drive on to. Yeah, it's day-to-day lives. There's so much we do, and the way we make decisions comes from how we were raised or the thoughts and important things that were instilled within us. And so why I'm saying that is when we look at culture, I think we have to be careful that we don't pull one aspect out of our culture and start saying, well, this is stupid, this doesn't make sense, and if you start picking it apart, some of that's okay, but if you pick it apart too far, you soon start throwing out a lot of things out of that package, and soon you don't have the culture that you had, and you may have thrown out some important things unknowingly. And I guess to try to explain that further is there are issues in our Christian lives. And just bring it down to our church. There's decisions we've made to do certain things certain ways. And we can ask, the question can come up, we asked, is it a salvation issue or not? And so if you look at one specific issue and say, well, it's not a salvation issue, so what importance is it? I think we have to be careful in doing that, because if you want to break everything, every issue down to a salvation issue, you soon will be left closer, and I hesitate to say, you're going to soon end up closer to the world's culture than you thought you would get to be if you make all your decisions solely on a salvation issue. And I don't know, I don't feel that I'm doing very good at describing that, but there's many places we can go, there's many things we can do that aren't salvation issues. Like if you go to a certain place that has worldly entertainment, you know, are you going to lose your salvation because you went there? Likely not. But what if you continue and that starts feeding you, and that's soon is your drive of life? Then there is a danger. So yeah, that's probably where I should open up for comments back. But as we do those things that are not salvation issues, look at it, stand back and look at it. In the future, where do you want your church to be or to go? And some of the things that don't seem important now will make a difference as to which way we make that decision in the future. Short term, but more so long term. Maybe we could see it clearer if we look longer term than just for today. We're also, and I'm really hitting some high points, and I should have spent more time maybe going across less. But there's an I, we mentality that has to be dealt with in our cultures, in our churches. So I find it interesting, sometimes you go to a place of business or a salesman comes to your house, and maybe sometimes you can tell it seems like they just came fresh from training or whatever, and how they'll use pronouns like of they're a salesman for their business or they're working for the business, so they use plural, we do this, we do that, and it's promoting the business spirit, and they're promoting that we're in this together. It's not they don't say I have found this and I do this. We as a group do this. And that's fine and good. So I think that's important then in the church too. It's not that I do it this way. I figured this out and I. But our foundation Our salvation is an I experience. So we bring our I into the we and creates the culture. If we always want to be an I don't think that force of a healthy culture can be created and move forward in a very healthy, forceful way if we're not willing to dedicate the talents and the energies and the goals we have, not willing to lay that out on a table, as it were, and come together as a group and make corporate decisions, if it were, for the benefit of the whole group. It's not about just my benefit or about your benefit, but what benefits the culture that we're trying to create. One more passage. In 1 Corinthians 11, which you don't even need to turn to it, because when we talk about culture, we end up talking about the veiling on the ladies almost every time. And I don't intend to do that here this morning, but this is a passage of headship. And so it's talking about men being leaders. It's talking about men being under God. And yes, it talks about the ladies having their heads covered. But that's just one part of that passage. And so it's talking about the headship order, where God's design for men under him to be leaders and for the ladies to submit to that. But men, for the lady to be willing or have any desire to submit to a man, that man has had to learn submission himself under God. It's not that the ladies are being asked to do anything that the men aren't asked to do, but we men don't see it quite that clear, maybe. So as Paul goes down through that rundown, and here again I might be off track, but he comes to the end there and he says something about, we have no other such custom. And we don't, what is Paul really getting at? What's he mean? So the headship thing, you know, you could say, well, this was kind of Paul's little, just his little thing here. He never heard, now I'm going to actually get to the veiling thing, I guess, to make a point. But Paul's the only one that ever talked about that, if you want to look at that aspect of it. We hear that as an argument. Jesus never talked about ladies needing to cover their heads and so forth. And so you could say, well, this is just Paul's thing. And maybe it was. What if it was? When he says, there's no other such custom in the churches, I think it says, he broadens it out not to the Christians. He was preaching this to the Christians, the Christian churches, wherever they were at that time. Was he not, and I'm asking this as a question, I guess, was he not promoting a culture that he realized needed to be implemented for the headship order to play out? There had to be a culture created and promoted and basically written down as a rule, an ordinance, that if you bypass the headship order, the Christian church is going to shipwreck. If man doesn't come under God, the building is going to fall. It's going to crumble. If ladies don't come under the submission of men in a healthy way, there's going to be family upheaval and disorientation to the point where families will be dysfunctional and churches will be dysfunctional. And so I wonder if he was simply creating culture in that passage of Scripture, saying, as he learned from Christ and as he was building on that foundation, this was something he saw very important. And he wanted it documented in Scripture. So it gives us a guideline to live and create culture today that will stand the test of time, that build upon that solid foundation. It will greatly benefit the future dynamics and movement of church and church life if we obey his, if you want to say it that way, cultural thoughts. And maybe that's lowering that scripture way too low. But to me, I think I'm trying to portray the value of culture this morning. That is something that would do us well to look at and take seriously. May God bless you all.